Welcome to another edition of the Exponential Podcast. I'm Todd Wilson, Director of Exponential. We're thrilled you're taking advantage of this free resource that was recorded at the Exponential Conference. It's part of a library of hundreds of hours of free training. In our mission to equip church planning leaders, we seek to distribute as many free resources as possible. Visit exponential.org to learn more and to check out the programming for the upcoming Exponential Conference.
Our session today is titled Moving from Linear to Rapid Church Planting Growth. And really what I want to do in our time is just share with you some of my learnings about becoming a rapid growth church planter. I shared in the interview that was screened today that I sort of stumbled and fumbled for many years, wasn't quite sure what I was doing, and things have started to change, and I want to share with you five, if I may call them, watershed moments and truths that I learned along the way, or to use the terms that Dave Ferguson used, five inflection points that made the difference for us. And just, they're not in any particular order. This is just the way they happen for us. I guess they could happen different for other people, and maybe there's a sixth and a seventh that I'm still yet to discover. I'm a learner, and so I want to learn as much as I can, and I know I haven't arrived yet. Our story goes back to the beginning of the year 1989, when I was called to be the pastor of this small Plymouth Brethren church that was struggling to stay alive, and it had only about 10-15 people left. And I was a young rookie, straight out of theological college, had accepted the Lord about 4 years before being sent to this place. I was hardly discipled. I was still wet behind the ears. I'd never sat in an elder's court. I wasn't sure what pastors do, but I was made the pastor. And I finally figured it out about 10 years later that I think what the elders of the church I was attending decided was, look, there are only about 5-10 people, so he can't do too much damage. Let's send him off there and let's see what he can do. And so I did, and I cut my teeth on that. And I didn't have a script. As a young pastor, I wanted us to plant churches. It was our wish, but we didn't have the know-how, and we didn't know what it takes to plant a church. And so in our first years of existence, we actually planted seven churches, and four of them died. So I wasn't doing too well. 10 years, seven churches, four of them died, only three survived. But in our second, decade, 10 years, we planted another maybe 15 churches, and most of them lived. Okay, so we're doing much better. Now we're beginning to learn. But in the last 6 years or so, we have planted about 80 churches. And our goal is to plant 300 within the next 2 or 3 years. And I think we're going to be able to do it. And we've learned along the way. We've made many mistakes. And I just want to share with you five inflection points or five lessons that helped us to turn the corner. And pray that they would be of great help to you. Let me say this as I begin, okay? Quit making excuses about church planting. We come up with all these reasons why we can't plant churches. We want to plant churches, but we're not able to plant churches. And, we blame, some people blame their mom. She just didn't bring me up right. And some people blame the elders. And some people blame their location. And some people blame the weather. And some people blame the budget. And we're always finding something, someone to blame. But you've got to quit doing that if you're ever going to plant churches. Church planting is not rocket science. And if God could use an ass to speak to his people, I think you're ahead.
Yeah.
He can use you. And it's not about rocket science. I actually believe that with faith and the willingness to take risks and step out, God will do amazing things. And I think all of us here could be used of the Lord in this way. So let me begin and say, here's the first lesson I learned about church planting. In Matthew chapter 9 and verse 37, Jesus looked on the peoples, and he said, the harvest is plentiful, but the laborers are few. I've been told to stay in front of the mic, and I keep wandering off, so let me try and do this. The harvest is plentiful, but the laborers are few. Pray ye therefore that the Lord of the harvest would send out laborers into the harvest field. Now, many pastors read that passage, and the way they understand the passage is, the harvest is plentiful, but the resources are few. Pray ye therefore that the Lord of the harvest would send more money so that we can get the job done. But by Jesus' definition, the need, the greatest need for kingdom work is not money. It's people to go out into the kingdom. And for us, our first inflection point where we began to learn about church planting was exactly this. If you have the people, you will plant churches. If you don't have the people, you will never plant churches. And so the question becomes, what is your leadership pipeline? How are you taking young men and women and training them up and sending them out to plant churches? Do you have a leadership development process? Do you take those young men and women and train them and mentor them and inspire them and envision them and commission them and send them out? Because if you're not doing that, you will never plant churches. It will remain a wish. I think a lot of churches here in the States are spoilt, if I may put it this way. Hear me out. They're spoilt in the sense that we have outsourced leadership development to the theological schools. And we wait until they graduate people, and then we get them to candidate, you know, for a position. So we're not doing the leadership development ourselves. And so the best, in a sense, are taken by those who can afford big salaries and such. And if you're leading a small church like we were, which was, you know, hardly able to pay anyone anything, we never see the best, because we sort of get the leftovers and the dregs when the ones who have the money can pick who they want. I want to inspire you and tell you that, you know, you need to develop your own leaders. And they're right there with you. Find them. Draw them to yourself. Inspire them. It's not about the money. We have the privilege of being workers in the kingdom, where the most important currency in getting people to give their very best is not actually what you pay them. It is the call that they have on their life and the opportunity to engage that call. That's what brings people. That's what keeps people. It's not the money. And so we all can do this. So the big question is, do you have a leadership development pipeline? Because if you don't, and you're sitting waiting for people to come, it's going to be, you know, a long wait before people come along and say, do you have anything for me to do here? So you do need to think about developing leaders. And here's my simple formula, okay? We have found that 60% of the people we train for the work of church planting end up planting a church. So I just play the numbers. If I want to plant 100 churches, I need to have about 150 people in training. And 100 of them, by, you know, the statistics, will go and plant the church. And the bigger your funnel is at the top, the bigger the flow at the bottom. Yeah. If you have a bottleneck at the top, then nothing comes out of the bottom. And so think about your leadership development. The first thing that Jesus did when he came wasn't what we tend to do. We hit the ground running, we're out on the streets evangelizing, we're busy trying to reach out to people, getting onto radio. That's not what Jesus does. The first thing he does is to choose the 12 leaders and to invest in them. And amazingly, after 3 years, he says, it is done. And he leaves the scene. And the kingdom begins to grow and has continued for 2,000 years. We've got it upside down. We invest ourselves at the expense of leadership development, whereas our first and primary target should be to develop leaders, and the work will get done. It's only a matter of time. So where do you find these leaders? Here's what we've learned. Number one is, they're right under your nose. Some of your best leaders are around you, but they're so close to you, you don't see them. You can't see their gifts. You can't see, you know, their abilities and their talents. You tend to look at other people's churches and other people's disciples and you think, if only I had that young man, wouldn't we change the world? And he's looking at you and saying, if only I had that young man in his church, man, wouldn't we change the world? We don't see the people who are right under our nose. And yet they are the ones that God has given us. So this is the first place you look at. Number two is youth pastors. I love youth pastors. I have a friend who's, in fact, he's here. Rob, you're here? Yes, he's at the back there, okay, somewhere. And Rob was telling me this morning that he's just been commissioned to go and plant a church by his church. He's been a youth pastor for how many years? 40 years. Been a youth pastor for 40 years and has just been commissioned to go and start a new church. His mother, is it your mother or your auntie? Your auntie finally says, now you are a pastor. And you know, I love youth pastors because I think they are rich hunting ground to find, you know, the leaders of tomorrow. Now, you know, there are many who are called to be youth pastors for life, but many start there because that's where the opportunities are. But their intention isn't to remain there forever. And so if you take these young people and build them up, who knows but what God will do over time. And so youth pastors, I hunt among youth pastors. I keep an ear to the ground with youth pastors. Theological colleges. We're visiting theological colleges in countries around Africa. And a lot of these young people go to college because they feel a call. But their church isn't committed to them. And they go and they train and they struggle through college. They don't know where they're going to after they finish. That was my story. Up until the night before I graduated, I didn't know where I was going. I just knew God had called me and he had called me to be a pastor. And if I didn't get a job, I was going to go out and plant a church. On the night before I graduated, the church I was attending came and said, hey, by the way, we're interested in you staying with us. They hadn't told me in 3 years of preparing myself. And I didn't know. And there are a lot of other people, free agents who are out there that we can go and inspire and get to know. We make it a habit when the theological colleges around us open, we're there on the opening day, we're speaking to the students, we're inviting them to come and do their field work with us. And over the time that they're with us, we get to know them. Some of them are coming from out of the country. And so they become our missionaries back to their own countries. We're trying to plant a church in every capital city of Africa. And these are great people to invest in because many of them do not have a church that has committed to them. And so I find leaders there. Number four is people in transition. People transition for several reasons. Number one is frustration where they are and they just need to move on. Number two is they feel my season, my time here has come to an end and I'm looking for something that will stretch me, grow me, expose me, give me new opportunities. Number three is that they have committed a sin and they were cast out of the church and we need to come alongside them and care for them and, you know, lead them through the necessary transformation and restoration and the process of forgiveness and rebuild from the core. But in time, these are wonderful people who have the call of God if only we would take the time and the trouble to build them up. Some leave because, you know, they just sense, you know, I just need to move on and I don't know where to go. We keep a very open door at the Nairobi Chapel. And we encourage people who are in transition to come and have a talk with us. And we pray over them and we bless them, even if they're not coming to us. What has happened over time is that when a pastor is in transition, they'll let us know. And sometimes what happens is I've gotten people who call and say, can I come and work with you? And I always say, you know, there is always work available if you're willing to plant a church because we're not done planting churches. We need as many leaders as possible. And so people in transition. Number five is harvest your congregation. When was the last time you made an altar call for people that God is calling into ministry? Somehow we've forgotten how to do that. And we don't do that much anymore. And yet God is in the business of stirring people's hearts and raising them up. And so, you know, just those mission messages where we call people who feel the stir of God, come, and we have a program in the church where you can work with us for a year. We'll build into you, we'll expose you to different sorts of ministries and give you an opportunity to begin to, confirm your calling. And because we're alongside you, we too will work with you about confirming that. At the end of that time, we may say, we truly sense that God has called you. Or we may say, you are called, but in a different line than you thought you were. And this is the direction you need to go. And some of the people that we have found that way. Number six is we keep a hit list. Okay? And what our hit list is we sit down together as pastors and we ask a question, who do we sense God is calling into ministry in our congregation? And, you know, Morathi, the young man that was in that little video, he was on my hit list. I knew a long time before he knew that God was calling him into ministry. I literally prayed him into ministry over a period of 2 years. But when finally the time came, he had a very deep conviction, and he has gone on to plant an amazing church in Nairobi. And so I keep a hit list. The Bible says that God does not do anything without revealing it to his prophets. And so I say, Lord, show me who it is you're calling here, even though it's only the first stirrings. Let me pray. Let me, you know, begin to focus on them, direct them where I can, and encourage them. And many of the young people that have gone into church planting went because I began to see this in them and to call it out of them, believing that they were people that God had, indicated to me. The last time we did this as a bunch of pastors at the chapel, we had 128 people on our hit list. And today, about 80 of them have gone into full-time ministry. And so keep a hit list. Number seven is universities and colleges and large gatherings. Right in this place, everybody who has come here has come because they are interested in church planting in one way or another. Everybody's a potential candidate. I weasel myself into, you know, a banner, because those young people are coming to what is likely to be a watershed moment in their life as they finish college, and they're asking, where next, and what is God calling me to do? And I want to be there so that I can, in a sense, put out my net and catch as many fish as I can. I want to go, you know, to large gatherings of students, student meetings, university, Christian unions, and hang around there, because that's where they come from, if only you can get to know them. And so I am proactive about it. I'm looking for people. I'm not waiting for them to appear. Number eight is start a church planting conference like Exponential. You know, I first ever came to Exponential because we had started a church planting conference in Nairobi. And here's what happened. We said, you know, we believe God is calling us to plant 300 churches over the next 5 years or so. But we don't know where the church planters are. You know, if you go to the theological colleges, half of them are spoken for, and it's hard to find people. And so we said, why don't we start a gathering where we get them to come, as opposed to us going to look for them? And so we started this church planting conference that we call Viral. And we offer free food, free lunches. We have speakers who have planted churches, and we advertise it around the whole nation and around, you know, neighboring nations. And we wait for people to register and come for the conference, as we have done here. Let me tell you a secret. Everybody goes home happy that they attended the conference. What they don't realize is that what we're really after was a registration list. Because we follow them up and we can have conversations. And on average, we find about 80 people a year from that list. We hold it every year and take about 80 from them. We don't have many people who attend. We have about 500 who attend it. And we walk away with a list of 80 who are interested in planting a church within the next 12 months. And so we can get into conversations with them. So start a conference or figure out what to do. Short-term missions are a great way to find people coming on the back end of the short-term mission who have convictions, a desire to engage. And if you don't water that seed in the ground, within a year it has dried up and died, because it landed on poor soil that did not have enough moisture. But if you do water it and pray with them, the weak side of short-term missions in many engagements is the people going out aren't very well prepared for where they're going on the front end. They go out and they have a powerful encounter with God on the field. They come back and everybody moves on. And nobody processes it with them. Nobody speaks into their life. Nobody calls anything out of them. Because we've been and done that, let's move on to the next thing. And it's a wasted opportunity. Because some of them encountered God in a life-changing way. If only somebody would stand alongside them and help them understand what they need to do. And so, guys, that's where I find leaders. 9 different ways to find leaders. And you can probably cook up a few more, share them with me so that I can get better at doing this. But I have come to believe that the harvest is plentiful. It's the leaders we need. So this was the first one. And guys, I want to say this. We began a program, a leadership pipeline development program, that has on average 100 university graduates coming in at the funnel end of the program. Our prayer is that we can retain 75% of them by the end of the first year. The 75% who go through that first year enter the leadership development track for church planting. And so we send them out to the churches to go and be exposed to what it's like on the ground. And so, you know, we send a church planter to Ethiopia and send 2 or 3 university graduates who have done the first year with them, you know, of the program to go and work with them. By the time they come back at the end of the second year, they themselves are ready to plant a church. And this is how we're planting churches. And as long as a funnel at the top end has many people going in, we will plant the 300 churches. We're right now at 105. We will plant the 300 that we've committed to. So that was number one. Number two, an important lesson I learned is send out sons and not church planters. And what I mean by that is this. Your son has your DNA. It's inscribed in them. You could start a church planting school and take people you don't know and send them out after whatever length of time you're going to train them, and you still don't know them and you don't know what they're going to go out there and do. The need is to turn those who come in into sons who have your heart and your passion and your values. And that takes time. It takes speaking into their lives. It takes meeting with them. It takes sharing your stories with them. It takes sitting around your dining table with them. It takes, you know, visiting their homes. It takes being there in moments of crisis and moments of challenge for them. It takes, you know, sending them out and then processing with them. And as they rub shoulders with you, they become your sons. Now, it's not language that is found outside of the Pentecostal church, particularly in the Western world, okay? But if you think back to the people who had the largest impact on your life and who you look up to, you probably would be proud to say, you know, that was my spiritual father. He shaped me, he molded me, he was there in my times of need, and I am proud to be associated with that person. That's what you're working at. Who are your sons? Do you have any sons that you're pouring your life into? It just takes drawing a young man, a young woman alongside you and walking with them for 2 or 3 years. That's what it takes. Sharing your life, opening up your life, doing life with them. And you're not sort of this super duper hero who lives on a pedestal that nobody can touch or reach and nobody really knows. It's what Jesus did with the disciples. He lived life. He did life with them. When you do that, your son always has 50% of your DNA. Not 100% because he's not a clone. He has 50%, okay? Which means he will do some things different from you. Because of that other 50%, blame it on your wife or your, you know, your husband or whatever else, okay? They will do something slightly different from you, but they will also always have your DNA. And the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. In a sense, you cannot guarantee what the outcome will be of the churches you plant 50 years from today. But if it was a son who went out, he will always desire to honor you for the role you played in his life, and to be faithful to the vision that allowed him to be a part of your life. That's what a son is. And if you send out sons, in a sense, you're halfway home, as opposed to just graduating people to go out and plant churches, and you have no sense of what they're going to do once they're out there. And so you have to then ask the question of, in our leadership pipeline, what process do we have to turn these who join the pipeline into sons? And for me, what that means is inviting them into our home, playing with them, going out to their home, going to visit their mother in the rural area or their relatives, getting to know them beyond their Sunday ministry, and getting to the place where we're rubbing shoulders so much that they look up to me as a spiritual father. I'm always accessible to them. I'm trying to do what I see Jesus doing for his disciples. He simply walked with them, ate meals with them, was there with them, saw persecution with them, etc., etc., doing life on life. This we found to be huge. And so, you know, this time round, I've come to Exponential, and I've come with several of my sons who have gone out and planted churches. And they're happy to be here. We're living in a house. We hired a house, and we're all living there. And so we're cooking meals together, and we're doing life on life, driving cars together. But I know for them to have this access to me over these next 2 weeks, because we're coming for Exponential, and then we're going to go and visit, you know, Universal Studios and Epcot Center and have some fun. But I know for us to be on those roller coasters, screaming our heads off, is important for these young men, that I was there with them and that we shared that moment with them. And so turn them into sons. In this way, you develop their convictions, you cheer them on as a father, you bless them, you tell them you believe in them, you affirm their calling, you speak into their lives, you're there during their hurts, and it will shape them so that they will always be faithful to your DNA because they are sons. Okay, that's the second. The third truth we stumbled on was this: plant seeds and not trees. Here's what I mean. I have a friend, okay? He's a pastor in the U.S. here. His church is 15,000 people, massively wealthy, in one of the richest counties in the U.S., okay? And he has a lot of millionaires in his congregation. And they had a building program 10 years ago, and one of the millionaires in his congregation said, you know, why don't we have an olive grove at the front of the church, okay? And they're in that sort of weather, so you can guess. It's either Florida or the South, or it's in California or somewhere like that. They're in that sort of weather. Why don't we have an olive grove in the front of the church? And this millionaire offered to go to Israel, uproot several olive trees, bring them back to the States, and replant them full grown in front of the main door of the church. Okay? Now, I looked at that and I thought to myself, I wonder how much that cost. It must have been tremendously expensive to uproot full-grown trees, keep them alive, ship them across the sea, replant them here, and support them until they are rooted. And, you know, they're growing now. There are five of them. And I thought to myself, I could have done that for less than $100. But the difference would be this. I would take seeds and put them in a nursery and have them shoot and then replant them into the ground. And for the next 20 years, I would watch over those seeds and continue watering them as they grew. And within 30 years, you would not tell that my tree didn't come from Israel. In other words, guys, many of the churches we know even today were planted as a seed. But we like instant big church. And so we don't want to plant seeds that will take 20 years. We want to transplant a living church into a new location. And in 1 week, we have 600 in attendance or 1,000 in attendance. And we call these satellite churches. And it's a great way to plant churches and such. But it's tremendously expensive. You plant 10 satellite churches and you're done. There's nothing left. the coffers are empty, and everybody's wiped out, and that's it for life. And so my motto is, plant seeds, not full-grown plants. I don't buy any land for the people who are planting churches for us. I don't build any buildings for them. I don't pay any salaries. I don't, you know, finance any big programs. I give them 18 months to grow the congregation to the place where it's a critical mass that can support them financially. I actually think they're struggling to put food on the table, and to pray God's grace into that church will make them and mold them. And it's a good thing, like a pupa in a cocoon that needs to fight its way out of the cocoon so that it can strengthen its wings and fly. And I plant seeds. And so here's my you know, the way we're doing it in Nairobi is we plant a lot of seeds. 10 people, and it's enough. If you go to the book of Acts, basically the churches that Paul planted were little churches in homes of about 10 to 20 adults. 95% of churches in the world are less than 100 people. When you come from a big church, you don't think a church of 100 people is a church. That's like a home group to you. But if you put it in that category, you have just wiped out 95% of God's churches around the world. What is it? What's a magic number that makes a church and not a small group? You know, when does a church become a church? You need to answer that question. In Paul's days, a synagogue was a synagogue if it had more than 10 men, 10 or more, and it was considered a synagogue. So what is a church? And we have decided we're going to keep the bar low. And I tell my guys, hey guys, if you start off with 10 people, you won. It's a seed that's been planted in the ground. Just give it 5 years. Go out and share the gospel with others. It will begin to grow. When you pass the 200 mark, you know, you are twice as big as 95% of the churches in the world. Stop getting hung up on numbers and trying to get to 10,000. Allow a seed to unpack its DNA and it will grow. You can't speed grow a tree. You'll just kill the roots by poisoning them with too much fertilizer. Just water it and grow it, give it the right amount of sunlight and the right amount of, you know, food, and it will grow. And stop trying to speed grow the church. And so we're planting little churches. But the churches were planted, some of them that we planted 4 years ago, 3 years ago, are at the 600 mark now, are at the 500 mark, and they're still growing. But I'm not buying land for anyone. They need to figure that out. And some of those big ones now are, you know, in capital campaigns to try and raise the money and such. I'm just planting the churches. They figure that out. You need to grow. That's where you cut your teeth. You know, you're not going to get a church like the one I'm leading by hanging around me and waiting for me to pop over and, you know, die. Go plant your own church. Go figure and grow in the process. And so I don't invest in trying to plant speedy churches. I just start small churches in large numbers. And even if 20% of them die, because I started 100, I'm 80 ahead of the guy who does the satellite church and is still working on number one, trying to get the money together. Okay, so I don't know. I think it works different here in the States because there's so much money in this country. I think maybe it can be done different. But number four, set the target and begin. I often say that part of the problem of, in my interaction with the Western Hemisphere, is it seems as though, you know how you go to a shooting range and you take a rifle? Okay, anybody who's fired a rifle here? I did once with a pastor in North Carolina who took me out. He had a hobby of shooting prairie dogs, which I gather are pests here. And so every summer he'd be off to Ohio, wherever, and, you know, he'd be popping off prairie dogs. And he showed me how to fire a rifle. You put the stock to your shoulder, you look down the barrel, you take a deep breath, hold your breath, and you go, ready, aim, fire. Okay, you pull the trigger. But when I look at the way that ministry is done here in the States, it seems as though you go ready, aim, 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 write the feasibility studies, do a policy paper, put down the values, figure out the budget, and it's aim, 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 and nobody pulls a trigger. We do it different in Africa. In Africa, we go ready, fire, and then you ask, did we hit anything? Did we hit anything? Now, I don't think either way is the correct way. I think we need one another. We need to learn how to plan and to strategize. And if you worked with an African church, you know what I'm talking about, okay? But I think there needs to be the courage in this context to actually commit and to move forward. If you come out of you know, this conference this week, and say, as a result of everything I've heard, by faith I'm going to believe God to help me plant 10 churches within the next 6 years. The game plan changes because you've committed. And I can already see that in, you know, a couple of places where I've seen churches say, we're going to plant 15 churches over the next 7 years. And they begin to ask the question, where are the leaders going to come from if we're going to keep that target and that goal? And they begin to find leaders, amazingly. And where's the money going to come from? Well, they begin to find ways to get the job done with or without the money. But it's because they committed. And I would say it's important you commit. We made a commitment to plant 300 churches. To be very honest, when we started off, I had no clue how we're going to do that. I've never planted 300 churches. I don't know how you plant 300 churches. But our constant prayer and seeking the Lord and reading the scriptures, we've read over the book of Acts over and over again. How could Paul go into a city? And within, you know, 6 months, he's planted a church and is leaving the church. We would say, Paul, that's irresponsible. How can you leave a church with only 6 months old Christians? But I think it's because Paul had a lot more faith in the work of the Holy Spirit and in the power of the gospel than we do. We think we've got to do it ourselves before we entrust it to God. And so we never graduate anyone. And look at the people around you. They have been discipled and discipled and discipled. Now they are confused. They don't understand the theologies anymore. You know, you've taught them too much and they'll never go anywhere. And we need to commit. And so I encourage you, and this was true of us, that you need to pull the trigger. Commit, make it a matter of faith. Bring it to the Lord, go share it with your elders, share it and advertise it in the church. Tell them, we don't know how we're going to do this, but God is a great God. I wish I could tell you a story that's unfolding right now. We made a commitment that we're going to plant 30 churches off the continent of Africa. We know nothing about planting churches off the continent of Africa, but ready, fire, you know, let's do it. And the first place we decided we're going to do this is in London. We're going to plant a church in London. So we got together with a church here in the U.S. and, you know, became very close and tight and said, let's do this, guys. And we don't know how to plant a church in London, but we told our congregations. We began raising the funds. We began training the leaders. Do you know today we are on track to planting a church in London? And here's what happened. We went to London and started scouting around. The Anglican Church heard about our desire to plant a church in London. We started meeting with the bishops, particularly the Bishop of Islington, who has been charged with the work of planting 100 churches by the year 2020. When he heard that we were in town wanting to plant churches in London, he invited us and has asked us, would you please plant 6 of the 100 that I need to plant? And we said, yeah, we'll do it. He has given us a church building and 2 flats, and they've worked out the work permits and, you know, immigration and everything. And in June this year, the team that's going in is relocating to London. They have committed to fast-track ordination within the Anglican Church so that our people can be ordained within the church. And once they're ordained within the Anglican Church, then the whole of Britain is open. You can go anywhere without ordination, and it is recognized and honored by the English people. We don't know anything about church planting. We don't even have the money to do this. But they're even going to pay a salary for the ones who, you know, we're sending in. And even more amazing, some of the ones we're sending in are young people. They've gotten, I think it's, is it two work permits? But the Christian Missionary Society, okay, the Anglican Church Mission Arm, okay, CMS, has come along and said, you know, we'll get them work permits, we'll employ them, they can give us a couple of hours, and, you know, we'll get them the work permits, we'll pay them a little salary. So it's all unfolding, not because we knew how to do this, not because we strategized, not because we had it figured out, but because God is in this. And God will do what you can't begin to see until you step out in faith and commit and decide, Lord, even though I don't know how it's going to happen, I am going to take a step of faith. You come through for me. And God will. And so we're planting a church in London. We're also planting a church in Hong Kong, in Shanghai, in Manila, in Sydney, in Houston, Texas, okay? And several other places around the world. So let me tell you, in February this year, we have a missionary pastor come to Nairobi. He used to be a missionary in Nairobi, and he comes and speaks with one of the old ministers in Nairobi and says, you know, we have a huge international community in Shanghai, and we want to start a church with them. We've been praying about this. We don't know what to do. Can you help me? And he says, yeah, there's a church here in town that talks about planting a church in China. And so, you know, they call me, and, you know, we sit down together, and he says, please, can you come and start a church in this community? And you know, China getting the permits and such is hard. And he says, you know, don't worry about the permits. We'll work all that out for you, because this will be under our umbrella. We don't call it, you know, a church. We call it a service. And so the Chinese government isn't threatened. They don't like church, new churches, but they don't mind a service, because it's just an extension of the same old thing. So actually, next month in June, I'm traveling to Shanghai with a couple of people to begin to see how we can begin a service in 2017 in China. I have no idea how to plant a church in China, but God goes out ahead of you. If only you will commit and step out in faith. We're now in the throngs of preparing to plant a church in Sydney, Australia. Again, I have no idea how to get into Sydney. But we come across this organization called Greater West for Christ that has committed to plant new churches in Western Sydney. And they're looking for church planters, and we happen to be in town. And so we're in the business now of actually relocating a family there to go and plant a church. God is in this business, and you can do it. So that was number four. Set a target and commit and see what God will do. And then number five, this one I learned from Exponential here, and it was courtesy of Dave Ferguson and this team over here, because here we are planting churches, you know, working very hard, leadership pipeline, raising up young people, university graduates, and sending them out and starting many new churches. And then I stumble across Dave Ferguson, and Dave Ferguson put this piece in place for me. He helped me understand the need for me to move from my addition model, even though rapid addition, to a multiplication model. And basically what a multiplication model is that we will double the number of churches we have every 3 years. What that means is you plant churches pregnant. In other words, if I'm going to plant a church, say, in Tampa, Florida, whoever I send out to plant a church goes with an apprentice who in 3 years will go out and plant a church. You plant pregnant and birth within a period of time. For us, it's 3 years that we've committed to, because that's what we've learned to how to develop leaders within a three-year time margin. But if you go present and this person is commissioned and they know in 3 years they're going to be asked to go out and plant a church, they're going to learn everything they can as a mentor under the church planter, and in 3 years they will be ready to go out. And then this person takes another person, and they're pregnant again for the next church. And the one who goes out goes with a young leader, and they go pregnant. And each time, to ensure that all our leaders have a resident who is in training and in 3 years will be sent out to plant a church. Plant pregnant. and in that sense double yourself every 3 years or whatever, you know, time commitment you make. Now, maybe it's not going to be 3 years, maybe it's 4 years, maybe it's 5 years. It doesn't really matter, because it means you're doubling and growing at a rapid rate. And by the time you hit 300 churches and you're doubling your numbers every 5 years, within 20 years, you have grown from the 300 to at least to 2,400 by the fourth generation. And they just keep growing, because it becomes a DNA of the church that we always plant pregnant and we always multiply and double ourselves every 3 years. And even if it's untidy, it's a lot faster than the addition that we're presently doing. If you add 100 churches every year, okay, which is our target for this year, by the end of 15 years, you would not have added as many churches. But if you multiply and double every 3 years, exponentially the numbers grow much, much, much faster than if you add. And so this is one thing that we're now trying to reorganize and restructure ourselves, that these young university graduate students would now become a part of that exponential growth through multiplication. So those are the five learnings that have been ours over the last, 6-7 years. We have a couple of minutes, so let me open it up and, you know, give your insight. I'm still figuring it out. I don't pretend to have all the answers. Maybe I'm making a real mess. Churches are being birthed in the process, so that's okay. Maybe you can help me clean up my act. Maybe you have a sixth, you know, way to do this that I need to learn from you. And so let's talk together. Let me open it up. Yes, sir. Yes, our leadership pipeline is a 2-year process, and in the third year you go out and plant. Okay, the congregation that I'm with presently is about between four and five thousand people. We meet in a really huge tent. We don't have a building, so it's just a, you know, one of these. I think you have those sorts of tents in California here. We're on the equator, so the temperature is always the same throughout the year. And, you know, it's Nairobi's high up, and so it's mild, and we can survive in a tent. And so it's a tent that seats about 2,000 people at a go. And as a result of the church planting we've been doing, now our numbers have grown to about 20,000 people in the churches that were planted. And what was said by Dave Ferguson, I have come to believe is true, that if you really want to reach people for Christ, stop growing larger and start planting churches. Would never have become a 20,000 size church. We now minister on Sunday, if you count the people who actually attend, to about 20,000 as a result of all the churches we're planting. We're now partnering up with churches around the world, okay? R.J. Lal, who will be speaking tomorrow, he's become a good friend, because nobody raises up disciples like R.J. RJ's disciples go into North India where they are martyred for Christ. And when I went and visited his ministry, I said, RJ, the disciples I produce in Nairobi are wimps. You know, if they don't have hot water, running water, and, you know, a European commode, they think they're suffering. I want disciples like yours who are willing to lay down their lives and be martyred for Christ. And so we've teamed up with him. And we've teamed up with, a church here in the U.S. And the idea is that we are preparing a global leadership track where we are seeking to raise what we're calling the Jason Bones of mission. Okay? And the idea is that they come and spend time in Africa, and we'll teach them how to do ministry with almost no resources and in very poor circumstances. They go over to RJ and they can learn how to suffer for the sake of the gospel. They can come over here and they can learn how to be rich and wealthy for the sake of the Lord, you know. Actually, it's how to navigate secularism and consumerism, which is, I think, the biggest challenges of the church in the Western Hemisphere. And so we're trying to raise up global leaders that we then send out. So this team that we're sending to London has been going through a similar sort of process. We have another team now we're about to start developing for Sydney and then for these other places that we want to develop leaders for. Yes. Yeah. Okay. Now, I said it's not rocket science. Okay. So we stumble across this passage in Matthew chapter 12. verse 33 onwards, where the Lord, where somebody came, a scribe came and asked Jesus, you know, which is the greatest commandment? And Jesus said, love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength, and with all your mind, and love your neighbor as yourself. And he said, the whole law of Moses is contained in this. In other words, if you are to shrink wrap the whole scripture, it comes down to these five loves. And so we made a decision. These are the five loves that we are going to teach, you know, church planters. Loving the Lord with all your heart is a matter of, you know, conviction. What are the convictions in my heart? You know, what drives me? What do I believe in, etc.? Loving the Lord with all your mind is a matter of comprehension. You know, engaging your brain to understand the things of God. Loving the Lord, loving your neighbors yourself is a matter of compassion. Yes, sir. So this is our, let me just finish with him. This is our curriculum at the base. How do you teach somebody to develop a heart of compassion? Easiest way is to throw them into poverty, to throw them into situations of need, to take them to the streets, to take them, you know, to the inner city, to take them where there is, you know, debilitating, destitute poverty and extreme poverty. And so that's what we do, and try and expose our people to what real poverty means. And when they see the brokenness of so many people live with, it just completely breaks their heart. When it comes to comprehension, well, it's a matter of sitting down and reflecting together and reading together. And there's no end to good books that you can read and process together. When it comes to, you know, loving the Lord with all your strength is a matter of competence. It's a matter of, you know, mentoring them, teaching them how to preach, teaching them how to wield the gift that God has given them, coaching them step by step until they are good at it, or at least good enough to go and invest it, and they can grow now as they, you know, plant the church. And so we're very intentional about these five things and how to grow these five loves, because together the whole law of Moses is wrapped up in these. So that's our curriculum. And we basically went back to Jesus and said, what was he doing? And so we copy as much as we can from what we see in the scriptures. I think the Western Church has been crippled by a couple of things, and probably one of the biggest things that has crippled the Western Church is the question of, is it safe? You know, is it safe for us to do this, to go there, to send these people out? And we have forgotten the place of suffering and the place of sacrifice when it comes to the work of the gospel. If you go back in history and look at the story of somebody like Count Zinzendorf, okay, coming out of Germany, Herr Huth, he was accused of sending young men around the world. These are the Moravians, sending them out to die. And yes, some did die because they went to dangerous places to serve the Lord, and they gave their lives willingly for the sake of the gospel. We don't know how to do that anymore. And so even sending out missionaries from this context, you know, they have to have medical insurance and evacuation plans and, you know, retirement. And, you know, there are so many things layered on that it's not the Western mission model has priced itself off the shelf. Nobody can afford it anymore. And we need to go back to the simple gospel where you call people to a commitment and a commission. I'll give you an example. For the people that we're sending to London, we have Steve Addison. Where's Steve? Steve is over here. Steve Addison's book, okay, he's written a book on movements, okay? It's available, I think, at the IVP stand at 40% off. It's a really good book, okay?
Bless you, Oscar. Bless you.
It's a really good book. And one of the things that I learned from reading Steve Addison's book is that when you look at the big movements, Christian movements in history, whether it is Francis Asbury here in the U.S. or it is people like St. Patrick of Ireland, most of the people who went out under those umbrella movements were people who were in their 17 to 25 age range. Okay? They were young. And the beautiful thing about young people at that age is they take risks. They are not afraid of danger. They don't have dependence. They don't cost a lot, and they will go where others won't go. If you take guys like us, you're asking, what schools will my children go to? Will I have a car to take them to school? You know, and you can't send people who are a certain age. They're just too expensive and too fussy. But these 25-year-olds will go wherever for the sake of the gospel. But we don't know how to send them. We're so wrapped up in the question of, is it safe? Do they have the insurance? You know, is that along the axis of evil? And we can't send anybody out anymore. And that's particularly so here in the Western Hemisphere. And we've priced ourselves off the shelves, unfortunately. So these guys that we sent to London, we asked them to make 3 vows. And again, you know, guys, I'm not a clever guy, but I'm good at copying, okay? And so 3 vows. To go to London. Vow number one is a vow of obedience, that they will fulfill the commission that we have placed on them. They said yes to the call, they said yes to the commission. We're calling them to go to London and for 7 years to invest their lives completely in planting the church there. Our hope and intention is that it will be led indigenously within the 5th year onwards, that it will not be a Kenyan church for Kenyans. It will be a church for the English, and their work is to be the catalyst to trigger it off, but it will be led by English people, okay? 7 years. A vow of obedience. It will get hard. They'll want to quit, but they must keep their commitment. Number one. Vow number two is a vow of poverty. We don't have the money to send them. They're going to live cheap. You know, they're going to learn how to live on 1 meal a day. And, you know, they won't have money. They're probably going to have to take the tube and the bus. There's no car, and et cetera, et cetera. A vow of poverty. To embrace poverty as a gift, as opposed to as oppression, you know, and to keep fighting and complaining and, you know, bitching about the fact that we don't have money, everybody else drives, we just have to walk, and et cetera, et cetera. A vow of poverty. But the third vow is a vow of chastity. They will not get married in those 7 years. They will not pursue a relationship. They will remain single for the sake of the gospel for the full time of their commission. Is it asking too much? No, it's not. But I remember talking with somebody about this, and, you know, this was an American missionary, and they said, you have no right to ask anyone to remain single and not to have a relationship. Who are you to ask that sort of thing? And I'm thinking to myself, you know, doesn't God call us to even give up our lives? This is wimpish. 7 years. You can't keep your zip up for 7 years and not, you know. And we have forgotten how to call people to a gospel that demands everything of them. And I think this is killing the church, particularly in the Western Hemisphere. Yeah. Our time is up, I believe. And so we're probably, well, we have 3 more minutes, so let's keep it open. Yes.
Are you seeing planting around?
Yes, yes, yes. Well, our DNA is leadership development. It's one of our DNAs. And so every of our churches begin their own residency program, internship, leadership pipeline. And so we have about 100 at the chapel, but some of the small churches have only 1 or 2, but it will grow as they become stronger and stronger. Yeah. Yeah. Mm.